What are some of the primary causes for Indigenous children being removed from their family environment and placed in out-of-home care?
So there are a range of causes. So some of the more primary causes relate to issues of exposure to family violence, which is often characterised as emotional abuse. It's widely recognised that exposure to family violence is damaging to children and is an unsafe environment for children to be in. And so we're seeing an escalation of the state becoming involved in situations where family violence is taking place in the home. We also have another leading cause or contributing factor to children being placed in out-of-home care, and that relates to neglectful environments. And these are environments where secure housing, for example, is not a sure thing, in that if women are escaping violence, for example, and are unable to find accommodation, that they're in effect homeless and are couch surfing, then they become they are open to being watched by child protection.
Of course. And how severe is the impact of being removed from the family home for these Indigenous children and their families?
It's significant for the kids, because, you know, all kids, whether they're Indigenous or not, all they want is the love of their mum and dad, and their primary caregiver that gives them the love and the support and the nurturing that parents give. And to be separated from your family and to be separated from all that you've known is a difficult time in the life of those kids. And to be put into a system where you don't know the people that you're going to be put with, because in emergency situations, there isn't a guarantee that kids will be placed with kinship carers, so they're not necessarily going to be placed with relatives. They will be placed in emergency accommodation, so they're not necessarily going to know the people that they're placed with. They're not going to be familiar with the rules. They might have to change schools. It's a scary time for kids to be put in out-of-home care in these situations.
Absolutely. So your research linked the overrepresentation of Indigenous children in state care and the barriers that Indigenous women face when trying to escape family violence. In what ways are these issues related?
So our research was looking at the connection between domestic and family violence and housing. And, you know, what are the housing options available to Indigenous women in the aftermath of domestic violence? And what we found was that there are three options. One is that to leave and go to a shelter, but routinely what happens across the nation is that domestic violence is a problem for all people across the nation, and there is a great demand for shelters across the nation. And so our women were typically turning up to shelters only to be turned away because the shelters are full. In these situations, the women were then reliant on family and friends to help them, to provide a bed for themselves and for their kids. And, you know, some family and friends will be open to taking women and children in these circumstances. Other family and friends may not be. It may be that they don't want the trouble that might bring, in the sense that if the partner finds out where they're located, it is quite possible that he'll come knocking on that door and causing trouble for the whole household. So, you know, people make decisions about whether they're going to accept a woman and her children in those situations based on their own perceptions of safety and managing risk. And then if they can't find a safe accommodation with family and friends, their only other alternative is to return to an unsafe home. In these situations, child protection is going to be all over the situation, because it is unsafe for children in these circumstances. And so mum is in a very difficult situation in this context. She either finds alternative accommodation or she risks losing the children.
Of course. Now, how could easier access to safe housing protect these women and reduce the numbers of Indigenous children in state care?
I think there are a number of things that we need to think about. The first and foremost is that we are going through a process of realigning Indigenous policies across the country at the moment, and reviewing those policies in line with the Closing the Gap refresh. And I think that in that refresh, we need to be looking at this gap area. We need to be looking at what are we doing to address this gap? And perhaps we need to have a target that says that that we are going to look more specifically at increasing the number of crisis beds and considering targets to reduce the number of Aboriginal women and children turned away from crisis accommodation, actually taking note of how many are being turned away and trying to reduce that number. I think we also need to put in place supportive, timely access to secure housing. Many of our women were put on waiting lists to get access to public housing. They couldn't, as many of them did apply for private rental, but the problem with private rental, as many of our women told us, was you apply online, then you turn up at the real estate to go and have a view of the property, only for the real estate to realise that the person is Aboriginal and to say that the property is gone.
Absolutely.
The discrimination was very much in the face of these women, and it meant that the private rental accommodation was not a market that the Aboriginal women could rely on. So they were very much reliant on public housing, and the public housing wait list in some areas ranged from 2 years up to 8 years long. And in these circumstances, you can be put on a priority wait list given your circumstances. But some of our women were equally disadvantaged in this space because they were not able to get onto that priority wait list because of housing debt. So in domestic and family violence related situations, what often happens is that the men in their lives have control of the finances. And the women have assumed that they're paying the rent. And what they inevitably find out is that they haven't been paying the rent. There'll be damage to the property as a consequence of the violence. And when she's wanting to get put on a priority waiting housing list, Department of Housing will often say, well, you need to make efforts to pay the arrears in rent and pay for the housing damage before we can put you on a priority wait list. So they can be waiting at least 3 months before they're put on a priority waiting list because of that housing debt. So we actually need to look at our policies and think about how we're disadvantaging our women in these circumstances. They should be being placed on those waiting lists immediately as we work out other means and ways of managing housing debt. Other areas that we need to also look at is around holistic solutions. One of our issues that we found in the research was that, you know, another innovative approach to looking at housing is to keep women in their homes and to exclude the men from the home. But the problem with that is that we, in excluding the men from the home, we also put him in a situation of homelessness. Because if he can't find a place to stay, then there is pressure applied to the woman to take him back. So we need to think about holistic solutions that actually address housing for men and women in domestic and family violence. We can't leave one out of the equation because the consequences is that the other is going to feel the brunt of it as well.